Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. My guest today is Daniel Ellsberg, best known as the whistleblower who released the Pentagon Papers and helped end the Vietnam War. An honors student at Harvard, where he earned a PhD, Daniel Ellsberg became a strategic analyst at the RAND Corporation and consultant to the Defense Department and the White House. He worked on the top secret study of U.S. decision making in Vietnam, which came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. Concerned about the lies being told to the American people about the war, Daniel Ellsberg had a change of heart, and in 1969 photocopied the 7,000-page study and gave it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and 2 years later released it to the press. His trial on charges with possible sentence of 115 years was dismissed on grounds of governmental misconduct against him, which led to the convictions of several White House aides and figured in the impeachment proceedings against President Nixon. He wrote about his remarkable life in an autobiography titled Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and is the subject of a movie, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, nominated in 2010 for an Academy Award. More recently, Daniel Ellsberg has been outspoken about Edwin Snowden's whistleblowing, and we're here to talk with him about that today. Daniel Ellsberg, I am honored and delighted to welcome you to All Together Now.
Well, thank you, and I'm very glad to be here, Eleanor.
Wonderful, and I so admire your courage through the years, and right now you've come real back in the front force of public view with this whistleblower, Edward Snowden. And we've heard a lot about Snowden recently and the information about the massive surveillance by the U.S. government on the people of the U.S., but much of the attention is focused on Snowden personally, where he's located, what country might give him asylum. But it seems to me that's been something of a distraction from the most important part of the story, the U.S. government surveillance of citizens. What do you think is the most important thing to learn from the information Snowden released?
Well, I agree with you that the media have been shown up here in a way, or have shown themselves in what I would say is very poor light, and Congress likewise, in focusing on the drama of Snowden's flight around the world. Granted, that's dramatic enough. It'll make a good movie, a good action movie in the sort of Jason Bourne style eventually. Maybe Matt Damon will play him himself. But that's not the important issue. I agree with you. And first of all, there's the information that he has so far released, and I expect there will be more of that. Glenn Greenwald, who first published this, along with Laura Poitras in The Guardian, has said that he got thousands of pages of information and that there are dozens of newsworthy stories, and only a couple have come out so far. So we can expect a lot more. Now, incidentally, Snowden himself has said, and there's no challenge of that certainly by Greenwald, that he did not reveal to Greenwald and he does not intend to put out anything that he thinks will harm any person, such as the CIA agents whose identities he knows or various other things which he thinks are legitimately kept secret. So like me, and I would say like Bradley Manning, although the public doesn't generally realize this, he has been discriminating and intends to be discriminating in what he puts out. And in terms of what we've seen so far, I would certainly agree with him in his judgment. He's shown very good judgment as to what should be out, and I would say much better judgment than the people who have kept it secret all this time from Congress and from the public. This information has been lied about by Director of National Intelligence James Clapper and by the Keith Alexander, the head of NSA. And wrongly, not only is it wrong to lie in any case in testimony to Congress, but they were concealing information that both Congress and the public needed to know. So on the one hand, I'm saying I hope there will be more attention to what this man has revealed and what he will be revealing and learn from it. And that hasn't happened adequately yet. Now, You've asked me what I think the important lessons are. Shall I go on that, or did you?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, first of all, so far he's revealed that privacy, as we understood it, most Americans understood it, and as we were assured by various officials, still survived, is almost dead in this country. Granted, people have been voluntarily giving a lot of information about their private lives to social media over a few years, and they understand that Google and Amazon and other places keep track of their searches on the Internet and so forth. They did not understand that that was handed over to the executive branch, which, of course, has the ability both to use it as a basis for criminal charges, and even more importantly, I would say, has the ability to use it to blackmail or manipulate the people that it has that information on in ways that Google and other corporations really don't have an interest in doing or an ability to do. Google doesn't really care that much, or if at all, other than to sell you, to get money from you for ads that it selects for you to see. But the government has an interest in getting support for its policies and for its staying in office, and especially for manipulating and defusing any challenge to its policies or to its secrecy about those policies. So the potential for the government, which has now been revealed by Snowden, to know every detail of our whereabouts through our possession of smartphones and their GPS capability, and to know every person that we've talked to, every call that we've received, and I feel sure that information yet to come out is what other NSA alumni veterans have been saying, which is, and I can identify those, which is that they actually know the content of all this material. There's been so much discussion now of the collection of so-called metadata, the information about who the call is to or from, how long it is, where it's from, and so forth. And people have revealed more than ever before how much that really does tell about you and about your private life. But the content also tells a lot, I would say even more. And I'm sure that they're getting all the content, as Russell Tice has recently revealed. He's a long-term NSA employee, now out of NSA, who had multiple clearances higher than top secret and access to this information. And he said simply, they get all the content of the conversations of journalists, congresspersons, and distinctly judges. He named himself having access to overhearing of Judge Alito, not probably a terrorism investigation of some sort. So what difference is it? The next point is, what difference does it make if they know entirely the private lives and all the communications? Let me focus on journalists. Well, if they know all the calls, both the even the metadata, but especially the content of all the calls that journalists make or are made to them by sources in or out of the government, what is left of the possibility of genuine independent investigative reporting or whistleblowing or a free press in general, able to be any kind of check on the government? And the same is true of knowing the entire private lives of congresspeople. Can there really be independent checks and balances then, when the kind of blackmail material that J. Edgar Hoover used to collect assiduously on every member of Congress, especially who had any influence on the FBI budget, he used that to keep himself in office, to keep his budget high. He made himself essentially immune, and he used it for other political purposes that he had at that time. If that's shared widely, not just in J. Edgar Hoover's personal files, which were shredded for him by his secretary when he died, and which every president was lusted after getting their hands on for their own purposes, what if that kind of material is widely available throughout the government? as Snowden is described by our president as a 29-year-old hacker, very dismissively. He's described as a low-level person, though that's somewhat questionable. But he himself said there were a thousand or thousands of people like him in his position. And he said very clearly, he said he didn't seem right to him that he should have access to this kind of information on every member, on judges, on the president himself, on journalists, on everybody else, not only he, but a thousand others of that sort. Finally, and we'll talk about this more, I think, I'm saying what that really points to is the question, do we want the kind of government that our founders designed, which is a government with three separate and independent branches of government that provide checks and balances on each other? Or do we not? Are we content to have essentially a single branch government, like most of the people in history, and as far as I know, even right now, actually live under? An autocratic, an authoritarian government, a dictatorship, a theocracy, some sort of, in any case, a single branch government that is answerable essentially only to itself and that decides entirely and without any question what the public shall know about what they're doing and why they're doing it, really, in private. And what prospects there are and what the costs and the risks of these policies are. In other words, a government without newspapers in the sense of an independent press that can really investigate them. I think we're very close to having that, and certainly we're moving toward it. And what Snowden has tried to do is to say this should at least be a subject of debate. And that's what he has succeeded, I think, in starting. Obviously, he himself believes, as I do, that that's not the direction we should be going and that there should be a check, a rein on the National Security Agency that collects all this information. And there is not now. What all of this shows is that the oversight that the president has referred to from Congress and the judiciary is basically a sham. The oversight and checks and balances have broken down, and we either set out to bring pressure to bear on Congress to repair that, or we accept what Madison, James Madison, described as the very definition of tyranny, which was a single person, or he said a single body of men. In his days, men were all you had to mention. A single body of persons here who essentially control the judiciary, executive, and legislative functions of government all in one body. And that's basically what we're getting now. It's certainly in the national security field and so-called homeland security field, a single branch government.
Right. There's
a long answer to your question, Eleanor, but that lays out the issues for us. We can discuss unless you broaden the plate even more.
Oh, that's fantastic. That really puts the issue squarely in the center of the table. And you're doing what I was hoping to see more of from Snowden. You know, here's a guy who risked his career, risked his life to get this information out to us, to the American people, so we would know what's going on. And we really absolutely must have more of this conversation in the country, and have the conversation be on this set of issues, not on where in the world is Edward Snowden today.
You know, I hope to hear more of it from Snowden himself, and I think we have to wait for that until he gets to a country like Venezuela, where I hope he'll be able to give interviews and write papers. He seems to be a person of unusual wisdom for his years of 29, certainly wiser than I was at 29, at 30 he is now. And I can say that definitely. So I want to hear more from him directly. But I suspect that one reason we're not hearing interviews really right now is that, unless he's moved, he's somewhere in the international terminal at Moscow, and he doesn't want to give away his exact whereabouts within that complex.
Right. I just want to underscore something you said, Dan, because, you know, a lot of our listeners may not have paid close attention to this, and to the extent they paid attention, it could be focused on where is Snowden. But the extent to which the national security apparatus now has surveillance on us as citizens in our own country, so that without any requirement of any real requirement of judicial oversight, is kind of a kangaroo court with a rubber stamp for all the national security, that the U.S. government can now essentially spy on anybody and everybody, that they collect all the information on calls made from anywhere to anywhere. They can know who our emails are going to and from, and as you say, they can know the content of all of that. And there is there's no protection, and now the people who are in the national security as employees know about all of this, have access to it, and there's really it's kind of the end of privacy in America. Would you agree with that?
I do, and you know, I've never actually focused on the issue of privacy myself, personally, over the years. I knew, you know, there's privacy law, and there are people who work on that, and there are NGOs that work on that, but it hasn't concerned me all that much until right now, thanks to Snowden, I really have begun to think about the problem of how does privacy really relate to democracy? Can you have democracy without a considerable degree of privacy from the government? I never particularly thought about that before, but now it does seem to me immediately that there is a very close relation there. Many, many people believe, I don't care what the government knows about me. I give them a lot of information to the IRS already. I give Social Security. They get a lot of information. I certainly willingly give it to Google or to Facebook friends or to whoever. So I have nothing to hide, is what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as somebody else has pointed out, the federal law system is so complex that almost anybody can be found to have violated something if the government goes over it with a magnifying glass what they've actually been doing. You're probably breaking laws that you didn't even know existed. And the significance of that is that if the government knows enough about you, it's like being followed by a police car, let's say. I think that's a fair analogy. I've often found myself driving along, police cars trailing me, and I'm asking myself, I'm looking at my speedometer, and I'm thinking, well, I'm doing all right. And then the light begins flashing. This has actually happened to me. And what does it turn out? That I have a broken light in my rear light, you know, in the rear of the car that I couldn't see and I wasn't aware of. But the policeman knows it, and there's a ticket right there. Mm-hmm. Well, and there can be, of course, a lot of other things, or you didn't turn exactly right and so forth. Now, maybe I'm overburdening the analogy, but I think that's true in very generally, meaning that you can be threatened with prosecution if they wanted to more often than people think are aware of. They think they're very safe from that, but they generally aren't if the government really wants to lay something on you. And it doesn't, by the way, have to be a case that they're sure to win. As Tom Drake found out, he can have, this is a big one now, running to the whistleblowing by a NSA employee. He was charged with basically totally tendentious charges that were essentially dropped in the end. And yet, he had been financially ruined in the course of that. Great strain on his marriage, as is inevitable in all these whistleblower cases. Years of having to pay lawyers and to prepare a defense and so forth, with a case that eventually gets thrown out of court pretty much with the judge admonishing the prosecution and what they had inflicted on this man and refusing to give him, when he did a plea bargain to a misdemeanor just to get the case over, of misusing a computer or something like that instead of all the serious felonies they've been posing to him. The judge said the prosecutor still wanted to give him jail time or a big fine. And the judge pointed out, are you kidding? You know, fine here when this man has had all his assets, all his savings eliminated now by your wrongful prosecution, really, all this time. The point is that the government is absolutely able to intimidate future whistleblowers just by the threat or the reality of actually charging them, whether or not they have a real case or not. And I come back to the point in particular of journalists and possible sources. I think that where we are right now, we're in the process with these unprecedented number of prosecutions that President Obama has chosen to wage, whether he wins any of them or not, is in the way of drying up and a willingness, chilling as the word is, chilling a willingness of people to tell the truth to journalists, even when they know that there are criminal acts going on or extremely reckless policies or that the government is deceiving Congress and the public in a major way, lying us into wars like Iraq or earlier Vietnam. They're unwilling to talk about it. They're willing, let's say, even less than before, which was never adequate now. And that means more wars like Iraq, a catastrophe, really, especially for the Iraqis. More wars like the escalation of the war in Afghanistan, more wars like Vietnam. And we could name places like Pakistan, Somalia, and others that may be in our future, Yemen. Iran would be a absolute catastrophe. I could sum this up by saying 58,000 Americans died in Vietnam and millions of Vietnamese died because there was no Edward Snowden or Bradley Manning at a high level with the conscience and the guts to tell us we were being lied into war. And many, many lives were lost as a result of that silence. And I was part of that silence in the early years. I'm trying to get rid of this. You didn't warn me to put my movies to get rid of this before we get on. And the same, of course, is true in Iraq. There, quote, only 4,000 Americans died, and I say only in the sense that unfortunately that should have been enough, but was not enough apparently to create an ongoing movement to shorten that war. And Bradley Manning played a critical role, I would say, in shortening that war in the end. But at least 100,000 Iraqi civilians died, and very possibly, and I would say probably, 10 times that number. That's a pretty big range of uncertainty. But unfortunately, the American public has not shown real curiosity about what the reality is in that range. But 100,000 is enough as a horror to think about, and the millions of refugees that were created in the course of that war. And that war occurred because none of the hundreds to perhaps thousands of people who understood we were being lied into that war to a wrongful war, a clear-cut war of aggression, none of them spoke out in the way that Edward Snowden has now done or that Bradley Manning did. So that's why I do regard them as heroes. I would, Manning and Snowden, I would be happy if the reality were that they're actions of truth-telling were essentially routine, and that it was fair to say they just did what they should have done, which I believe is true, and that it was something that we could expect to be done in time to save many lives. Unfortunately, that's not the way it is. That's not the world. People don't do what they should do in these circumstances. It's very rare. And again, I say that's why I honor Manning and Snowden for doing that.
Right. And I want to pick up on the point here about this need to balance a desire for privacy with the desire for security, which a lot of these government surveillance programs are sold to us on the basis of, well, we need this to keep safe, particularly in the post-9/11 age of terrorism. And I've been concerned looking at recent polls that show many Americans do not object to this surveillance because they believe it does make us more secure. So what would you say to the people who argue that we need this surveillance to be secure?
I would say, first of all, don't rely exclusively or very heavily on the judgment about these matters from the military-industrial complex itself or the executive branch itself. Very specifically, we get back to this question of three branches of government. The truth is that our Constitution and our form of government is not based on absolute trust in the president, very simply, or in any one branch, or in any one congressperson. The Constitution was not designed to be executed by angels who were thoroughly trustworthy, but rather to have institutions that were sufficiently independent, they could investigate each other. The Congress in particular could investigate with subpoenas and could hold executive officials who lied to them accountable in various ways, and prosecutors who could do that. We don't have that now. We have essentially at least two tiers of the law here with virtual immunity for executive officials in particular in the national, what's called the national security field. So the first thing is, then I would say, is informing a judgment as to what is actually needed for our security. Don't rely on the kinds of people who judged that we ought to be fighting in Vietnam, or we ought to be and had to be fighting in Iraq to protect ourselves from terrorists. What we've been doing in the way of drones and assassinations, in the judgment of people who really look at patterns of terrorism, say is we've been recruiting. We are the essential basis for the recruiting for al-Qaeda among a population that has come to hate us, literally hate us, not just disapprove or dislike. In Pakistan, an unstable country with nuclear weapons, to have them hate us very understandably because of our what appears to them almost random killing of civilians and innocents in our pursuit of civilians by drones over there, is very dangerous. It shows to me very bad judgment. And I'm speaking specifically here of President Obama, who has greatly expanded that drone program in Pakistan. I think that's disastrous judgment. And but look at Iraq, which is, of course, even worse, and for which we have George W. Bush in particular to blame, and Ron Obama, I would say, for continuing it as long as he did. Okay. Who should we believe on matters, let's say, of what's needed for security? I'll give you, on the one hand, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who says that this program of mass dragnet surveillance of metadata, that's all he's admitted so far, is necessary and essential to our security. Well, in March of this year, he was telling the Senate in testimony that a central program didn't exist. It was a flat lie. He was asked whether we were collecting any sorts of data at all by Senator Wyden on millions of Americans or hundreds of millions. The true answer was hundreds of millions is correct, perhaps close to 300 million. And he said, no. Well, now, why should we take seriously his information when he tells us, oh, well, that was wrong. He even apologized for it. He said, yeah, I had an odd meaning of collect in my mind. We analyze it, you know, and so forth. And then on another occasion, he said, oh, I forgot about the Patriot Act under which we're collecting this stuff and so forth. Why should we believe him at all when he says it's necessary for security? That's the first point. Second, who should we believe? Well, I would say a guy like William Binney, who was the 30-year, almost 40-year veteran of NSA, who designed the program they're using in his collection. Only he designed it with protections for the privacy and protections that kept it within the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution against unreasonable search and seizure. I'll be very specific here. I think very few people have heard this. He said when he designed that program that they're using, he designed it to be to encode information relating to Americans who were not specifically suspected of associations with terrorism. They weren't associated by 1 or 2 degrees of separation with somebody who was a suspected terrorist. Now,
Dan, I'm going to need to interrupt you now for a station break, but hold that thought and we'll be back shortly. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Daniel Ellsberg, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower who released the Pentagon Papers and helped end the Vietnam War. Dan, just before the break, you were talking to us
Let me sum it up. Yes, what
sure.
I was saying.
Who do we believe and what's needed for security?
Sorry. William Binney, who's as great an expert as has probably ever existed in the NSA on the making of codes and the breaking of codes, actually designed a system he called Thin Thread, it was a code name, for gathering up all this metadata around the country and encouraged its use after 9/11 especially, though he felt that system, had it been adopted earlier, would have prevented 9/11, okay? But he had built it with privacy safeguards, which can be described fairly simply. Basically, it automatically encoded anything that was caught up by an American in this country who was not suspected of being a terrorist and who was not in direct communication or second-degree communication. He wasn't talking to somebody who talked to somebody who might be a terrorist. That's a fair number of people right there, but it excludes most of the people, most of the country. So everybody else's metadata or contents would be encoded. And it could not be sent around the government. It could not be used by law enforcement or any other political purpose at all unless evidence developed that gave you a reasonable basis for suspicion. There might be some connection with terrorists, in which case you could go to the court, the FISA court, the secret court here, and get a warrant for listening to both metadata and the contents of the conversation. Of all this communication, and you would then decode it. Okay, all this could be done automatically, basically by computer, and it would preserve the privacy. And in Binney's strong judgment, you would have gotten all the possible security benefits that you could reasonably hope to achieve, and you would not have in your possession all of this private data on people who did not have even a remote connection with terrorism. In other words, it can be done. The security, in their judgment, who should I believe, Binney or Clapper? I don't have any hesitation there. Clapper, on the one hand, I say, first lies that the program exists at all. And then second, when he admits it exists, he says, yes, but it's essential. Well, should we rely? What is his judgment worth? He's shown it may be a very sincere judgment on his part that it's very helpful and very necessary, but his background is entirely in spying. He doesn't show any indication whatever of seeing any value in either privacy or democracy. He doesn't show any judgment, nor does Keith Alexander, in charge of NSA, that doesn't qualify him very comfortably to be a member of the East German secret police, the Stasi, whose ambition, like theirs, was to know everything about the lives and conversations and communications of every citizen of their country. And NSA, according to Snowden, has the same ambition, except that their ability to do it for technical reasons now is beyond the wildest dreams of the Stasi back in the 70s and the 80s. The communication means they can now listen to didn't even exist then. You didn't have personal computers or the internet or even fax, I don't believe. I forget exactly when that came in. But you didn't have the credit transactions, credit cards, and above all, smartphones with a knowledge of exactly where you were and the ability to correlate exactly who you were meeting with at any moment of the day. One man's privacy is another man's or person's ignorance. Do we want the government to be ignorant? Well, at first glance, Alexander or Clark would say, well, no, the more the information, the better. How could we want them to be ignorant? If I was a journalist, I have to say, and I am a source, I want the government to be ignorant of the full scale of my interactions with journalists, or if I'm a journalist, everybody I'm talking to in the government or out. I want the government to be ignorant of that. Otherwise, I couldn't possibly do my job. And likewise, as a congressperson, I don't want some agency in the government to have the super capability that J. Edgar Hoover aspired to. And therefore, it all depends on how you ask the question here to people. Do they want privacy? Do they think NSA is intruding on their privacy? They'll say, yes, I want privacy. I think there is too much intrusion. That's what current polls are showing, and saying that Snowden did the right thing by informing us. But if you ask them, do you want security? They will, of course, say yes. And if they believe unquestioningly the president or the people whose only concern is security, that is secrecy, and has nothing to do with democracy or whistleblowing or privacy, if they believe those people, they will feel comfortable with what's going on right now with the NSA. But they shouldn't. I'm sorry to disturb their comfort, as Snowden is doing, but I have to tell you, I think our democracy is in real danger and has already suffered very great erosion. And I agree with Snowden. It's worth an American's life and freedom to try to reverse that trend toward single-branch, essentially tyrannous government.
Right. Well, I'm interested in what you're saying about the William Benny's design to get the metadata that would encode it unless there was some reasonable cause to get a warrant to break into the code. But what is the likely? I'm thinking now, what do we do to kind of restore some element of privacy, restore some protections on the information unless there's, reasonable cause to
investigate? Well, that can be done technically, as I'm saying, and to the layperson like myself, without hearing from Benny, it wouldn't be obvious whether it's possible at all. I forgot to mention that what Benny said they eventually did was to take his program, FinThread, and strip it of the privacy, strip it of all that encoding capability, strip it of all the privacy conditions that he'd built into it, so that it was total surveillance. And he said, I have to apologize to the American people, he said in a recent interview. I feel guilty that I designed something that is being misused in this way, and I'm responsible for it, and I'm sorry that that happened. But that could be reversed. The original design could be gone back to. Actually, technically, it probably wouldn't even be a great problem. And put that dragnet, universal access to this surveillance out of the hands of government. Now, there's hardly anybody most of the people, I should say, in the executive branch are not going to want to do that. Once they have the information, they say, well, good for us. You never know what might turn up. And the problem is, of course, that secretly they have a lot of other uses in mind for it, many of them, other than simply looking for terrorists. As Benny said when asked why they had stripped those privacy conditions out of his program, he said, they want leverage on anybody, on everybody. Every Every power center would want that. More power rather than less. Knowledge is power. Secret knowledge is power. Knowledge of your secrets is power. And the ability, it's leverage and the ability to manipulate, and they have lots of uses for that. So you can't rely on the executive branch backing off from this at this point now. How about Congress? Unfortunately, the leaders in Congress have all been made complicit in this, basically. They've been co-opted. The heads of the intelligence committees are clearly serving no oversight function at all. And the people who did object to it, like Senators Wyden and Udall, on the Intelligence Committee, were gagged from even telling their fellow colleagues in Congress or even their own staffs what it was they were objecting to or worried about. They thought this was unconstitutional, but they couldn't tell us or the courts because it was classified. And if they put that out, they would be within their rights, almost surely, as members of Congress, to say that, especially in a closed session of Congress. But they would be thrown off the committee. I have to say, even they don't appear in the best light, from my point of view, in their determination to keep access to the information and stay on the committee rather than to do anything effective to stop this unconstitutional program. But at least they are speaking out now, now that Snowden has taken the risk of putting it out. And there's a number of lawsuits now, the ACLU and others, challenging the constitutionality of this. And if you're asking, well, what could possibly be achieved, the answer is there could be, in the first instance, you can change these actual programs technically so that they don't put in the hands of low-level program analysts like Snowden himself and his colleagues this kind of information. And second, and go back to warrants, you can change the Constitution, the nature of the FISA court, to keep it from being, as you put it, a kangaroo court with a rubber stamp. That phrase comes from Russell Tice, by the way, who I quoted earlier. Mm-hmm. And you can really move toward, try to bring pressure on the leadership, like Pelosi and the others, Harry Reid, to get genuine oversight. That's going to be very hard, but if you don't try, you're not going to get it. And we have lost it, basically. So NSA right now, and the intelligence community in general, is out of democratic control. It is with the FBI and the CIA and the DIA and all the other members of the intelligence community. It's what I've called a united Stasi of America.
Yeah, it's a grim picture. So that's what I'm interested in exploring with you is, you know, what can we as American citizens do given the current situation? So what I'm hearing you say is that if we can mobilize and put pressure on Congress, maybe they could form a select committee to investigate their revelations by Snowden and the rest of the intelligence community and really restore the, you know, they have the technical capacity to restore where they can listen to what they have to listen to, but they can encode the rest unless there's reasonable cause. So do you think that's the route, is for we, the people, to put pressure on our members of Congress to restore that encoding?
It's the only hope that we have, I think, the only route. And I'm not going to pretend that it's either easy, it certainly isn't that, or that there's any guarantee that this can be done, or even that the probabilities are very high. Actually, none of that is true. There's a chance. I think we have a chance. And the government that was given us, which still exists in form, still has enough elements of democratic nature and accountability into it that gives us a chance to reverse this process. The three branches of government have essentially colluded here and all been complicit in not only unconstitutional behavior and even criminal behavior, but covering it up and keeping it quiet. We can, as a public, we don't have a police state yet, by no means. I wouldn't be talking to you. This program wouldn't exist. And Snowden's material would not have been published in this country if we had a police state already. We just have the infrastructure of a police state to an extreme degree. But it hasn't been, we still have a lot of free speech left. So the question is whether we use it or not. And only a movement of the kind we saw for, go back in time here, women's suffrage, the abolition movement, or union movement, civil rights in particular, very much so, and the anti-war movement, movements like those, women's liberation, gay liberation, all of these things. We don't have, I would say, much corresponding to that at this point. Gay liberation has had some successes lately, and the immigrants are making themselves heard in part by very large marches and pressure on Congress. So we do see some progress. We don't have a movement against the surveillance state yet, but Snowden has, I think, raised the alarm in a way that creates the possibility of a kind of movement. RootsAction.org has had petitions. There are many people who have had electronic petitions to Congress supporting Snowden. And the effect of that is not, I think, in the face of the president, going to give Snowden much protection. I'm sure that the executive branch really is obsessed with shutting him up one way or another. And I think his life is in considerable danger, as he said himself. I'm not even sure that kidnapping would be a preferred solution here. I have to say, I think the Osama bin Laden approach of really shutting his mouth is probably preferred. They really want him quiet. And that means that if he were to come back, or if he were to be kidnapped and brought back, what he has to look forward to is solitary, extreme conditions of incommunicado. And that's why I've said that I think he was right to be, and is right to be, out of the country making these revelations. But anyway, they give the possibility for people now to begin to act, not only with petitions, but with demands on Congress and with lawsuits, that we want our three branch and government back, and an independent press back. And pressure on the press, by the way, is here is very due. A number of journalists have been acting in a really quite extraordinary way, saying, "Keep us ignorant. Stop all this leaking." The Washington Post, which published Snowden's first revelations, then has been having editorials and column after column in their opinion columns denouncing leakers and denouncing Snowden specifically. It's a rather extraordinary picture. It would be as if the New York Times or the Post, to whom I gave the Pentagon Papers, had editorial saying, above all, make sure that Ellsberg has a good long prison sentence. They weren't so far from that, actually, in some respects, when it came to the criminal prosecution. But really, they didn't come out and say it was outrageous that someone leaked the Pentagon Papers to us. And the Washington Post has been very close to that in this, not the Times so far, or the Guardian, certainly.
Right, but, and I think it's particularly tough having the free and independent press at a time when, you know, the newspapers are under siege anyway financially. So many of them have already gone out of business, or many of them that are still around being taken over by some of the right wing, like the Koch brothers wanting to buy several credible papers. So it's a very tough time for the newspapers anyway, but then to have, this extra pressure is really challenging.
Well, then, we have, like, David Gregory on TV actually asking Glenn Greenwald, who revealed this, who was the journalist for whom Snowden was a source, why should you not be prosecuted? Meaning, are you not aiding and abetting a criminal here in doing your job as a journalist? Well, that's exactly what was sworn to by an FBI agent about James Rosen of Fox News, that in printing, in publishing on Fox, mm-hmm. television, the revelations of a source, he was aiding and abetting a criminal act. I think this administration is moving very quickly toward prosecutions of journalists themselves, not only of their official sources. And are we seeing a real journalistic kickback against that? I think it's beginning because it's getting their attention all of a sudden, but and it should have been there for decades, but because the possibility was always there. But it's being realized now under Obama, a direct attack on journalistic freedom to publish the work of whistleblowers, and not only on the sources themselves. So there is another thing that the public can, we can press the media on this, letters to the editor. I would say deputations to editorial staffs, something I'm not sure we've ever seen. That says, in effect, you know, what do you mean by editorials like this? The Washington Post, I would like to see some real pressure put on them on that. And I must say, they just published a piece by me for the first time ever, actually, in 40 years. So here I am complaining. And actually, I did get a piece in the op-ed here saying that Snowden was right to be out of the country, which was directly contradictory to their editorial policy. So let me give them credit for that.
Yeah, well, there's some good news there, and I think it's good to congratulate them when they're doing the right thing and then pressure them when they're doing the wrong thing. So,
well said.
Yes. So just so we're clear here as we're launching this movement, and we just have one more minute here, but Daniel, if we could wave a magic wand and say from this interview a movement gets started in the United States, what would you say should be the top three things that this movement should do?
Well, I should have that answer right at the tip of my tongue, but I would say first, protest the use of the Espionage Act by this administration as if it were a British Official Secrets Act that criminalizes all leaks of classified material. We don't want an Official Secrets Act in this country, and we can't have it. We should protect the First Amendment in that respect. We should protect the Fourth Amendment and demand it back in terms of a searches that are going on now, surveillance, mass dragnet surveillance that absolutely amounts to unreasonable search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And thus, we should protest by not only petitions and letters to the editor and letters to congresspersons very much, demanding that they serve their actual constitutional function of being a check on executive abuse, executive overreaching, and that we need an actual oversight machinery that goes far beyond, it does very much better than the sham Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that now exists in the judiciary, the secret court, secret hearings, secret decisions, and goes beyond the Intelligence Committee's oversight, that we need to get back the actual functioning that was designed in the Constitution.
Fantastic. I'm all for it. So for listeners who want to learn more about your work, they can go to your website, which is www.ellsberg.net, ellsberg.net. Is there any other source that you'd like to steer people to?
Well, I read yes, Glenn Greenwald every day in The Guardian.
Glenn Greenwald in The Guardian.
So I think he's the best commentator on this, and he has many links, including to the people he criticizes. It's worth looking at those, and to other people who write along the same line. So that's a very good source. I also look at antiwar.com every day, and commondreams.org is another thing.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. Daniel Ellsberg, thank you so much for being on the program and for all your wonderful work as a patriot.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks. Bye, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Let's really show.